Imagine a world where innovation knows no bounds. At BAE Systems Fast Labs, we're pioneering advanced technology and defense research, shaping the future of safety and security. Explore our website to uncover a realm of cutting-edge projects, collaborations, and visionary thinkers. Whether you're a tech enthusiast, a defender of freedom, or just curious, Fast Labs is where groundbreaking solutions are born. Join us and be part of the future today. Visit www.baesystems.com/fastlabs. Welcome to From the Crow's Nest, a podcast on electromagnetic spectrum operations, or EMSO. I am your host, Ken Miller, Director of Advocacy and Outreach for the Association of Old Crows, and welcome to our live recording of this episode of our new bonus subscriber series. So I want to thank everyone in the audience for joining us today, and of course, my guests, whom I will introduce here very shortly. So before I do get to introductions, just a word again on how this works, as we are starting to get the word out and new audience members are coming in. We are launching a new subscription package that provides subscribers two additional episodes per month in between our regularly scheduled From the Crow's Nest episodes. So you can subscribe to this via becoming an AOC member. AOC, it is a benefit of becoming an AOC member, or once we get the subscription paywall up, it'll cost $2.99 a month to subscribe. We don't have that paywall up yet, so we're basically approaching these as bonus episodes, so they're free to everyone, and anyone can join in, and we welcome your participation. But these episodes will be run a little bit differently from our normal episodes. We are going to focus a lot more on just kind of casual conversation, what's in the headlines, current events, and you know what issues are relevant to the EMSO community versus maybe specific technology topics that we cover in the regular episodes. So most importantly, though, subscribers and AOC members can become audience members to the live recording of these episodes. We record today. We release these episodes the next day. You can be in the audience, and we of course encourage then your participation. And the lights just went out in my office, which I will address here shortly. So bear with me. You can, as an audience member, you can comment, you can ask questions, use the chat function. You can do so anonymously. Let us know that you're here. Let us know your name, but we will not share your name over the air or anything. But we like to know who's in the audience. So please take a moment, just say hi in the chat, ask a question or comment. That's how you can communicate with us. I also have with us here today, Laura from Vox Topica Studios. She's our producer. She's going to help me manage the chat, and of course, monitor anybody who uses that function to let us know that we don't miss any questions. And finally, I am coming at you today, from sunny and a little bit too hot San Antonio, Texas. I'm here at the National Security Collaboration Center at the University of Texas, San Antonio. The AOC is hosting a workshop on EW resource and integration challenges. There's a tremendous stakeholder community down here, and we're having some great discussions this morning. We had some briefings this morning. We have some workshops this afternoon. I'm taking my lunch break to be here with you. So I want to welcome everyone who might be even joining us during their lunch break, logging into through the link. Our very own Matt Thompson is, whom I've had on the show a couple times. He is running the workshop. I'll probably have him on here in a couple weeks, either on this show or the regular From the Crow's Nest, to kind of let us know what we learned from this workshop today. So with that, I want to welcome my guests to the show. I am very pleased to have with me friends and colleagues from Forza DC, Madison Arcangeli and Katie Nazartova. Forza DC is a women-owned federal strategies and consulting firm. Madison is the founder and managing partner, and Katie is director of national security and technology policy. Of course, those of you familiar with AOC know that they help AOC with our congressional education program. They both come from Capitol Hill and are both very well connected to what's going on. So welcome, Madison and Katie, back to the From Crow's Nest. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So we have a lot to talk about, and hang on, I'm going to hit the light here. Hopefully this works.
It's been one of those weeks with technology.
Apparently it's one of the timer. it's one of the timer things, and I guess I haven't moved enough that it thought that I'd stopped existing for a moment.
That's always nice.
Yeah, it makes you feel good that you're not being seen. So we have a lot to talk about today. Last week we talked about how we were going to run the show. A huge long list of topics. We have the fiscal year 2024 appropriations updates. What's going on there? We have the 2025, the start of the National Defense Authorization congressional process. We have Ukraine war supplemental. President's budget's on the way. We have the State of the Union on Thursday. And of course, last but not least, certainly is today, on Tuesday, March 5th is Super Tuesday, known as Super Tuesday in the primary election schedule. So a lot of states are having their primaries on for their congressional candidates, their Senate candidates, House and Senate, and then of course the president. So after today, we'll pretty much have a good idea of kind of where things are going in advance of the November general election. So a lot to talk about. I wish we kind of had a wheel of fortune wheel to kind of spin to see, what goes first. But I think, I want to talk a little bit and kind of more urgently, because a couple weeks ago I had Colonel Jeff Fisher on. We talked a lot about the need for Congress to act on Ukraine war spending. This is a vital step to help the Ukrainians in their fight against Russia, to keep those advances at bay, and to actually, at the end of the day, we can end this war with the right amount of support, both from the U.S. and internationally. Central to that, of course, is what the U.S. contributes to the war effort. So the war supplemental funding has hit a rocky road here in Congress. I'll let you, Madison, I'll turn it over to you or Katie, talk a little bit about what is going on. What is the state of the obstacles the state of the Ukraine supplemental? What are some of the issues people are concerned about, and where does it stand here on March 5th?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've been talking about Ukraine funding for a really long time at this point. It's desperately needed, and a lot of most members understand that. In terms of what is consuming the attention of Congress right now, they are distracted trying to finish up fiscal year 24. We're 5 months into the fiscal year. It's kind of a big deal. But Ukraine is also, it is a top priority. And from the members that we have talked to, member offices we've spoken with, I think some people believe that there is still a path to be able to get it done. I think more people agree that it's needed and are less optimistic about how it could get done. But there are efforts underway right now to try to make that happen. The House Democratic Leader, Hakeem Jeffries, is trying to find some way to work the Senate deal that was passed that included Ukraine funding for Indo-PACOM allies, Taiwan, Israel, all of that. Trying to find a way to work that and have the border piece included so that it doesn't alienate Democrats from voting for it in the House. Because that's, immigration is going to be, really touchy for that.
Now, is there too much in the supplemental that it's partially kind of a victim of its own weight? I mean, there almost every major provision in there is controversial in some way, or has become controversial and politicized. Is it more of a ideological split? And when I mean that, not between necessarily Republican Democrat, but between certain members on the right and the left who are not going to vote for anything or vote a particular way, no matter what the topic, in terms of what's in the bill.
Yeah, absolutely. There's, with all those funding buckets that I just listed, there are divisions within both Democratic and the Republican sides of the aisle in Congress. There are Democrats that are very concerned about sending money to Israel with the current humanitarian crisis in Gaza. There are Republicans who are very uninterested in sending money to Ukraine, whether it be concerns of corruption, how is it being used, accountability, oversight, or for other reasons. So those absolutely do exist, which is part of why this is hard. I think it was brilliant at first to tie some of these other pieces, especially border security, to something like Ukraine, because you're trying to incentivize people to vote for something they don't necessarily want to vote for by giving them something that they do want. And then that sort of imploded after the Senate passed it when Donald Trump weighed in on the deal.
Well, and this seems to be, you know, like particularly with Ukraine, I mean, obviously at the beginning, there was a lot of support. You know, you had Russia invading another country and you had a lot of initial outcry, you know, the need for U.S. to contribute, you know, NATO needs to get involved and so forth. Now we're about 2 years in. And I mean, you could ask me, average Americans, like, you know, what's going on over there? What advances have been made? What good is this next package going to do? There's a lot of just people aren't as up to speed or familiar with kind of how this supplemental fits into the larger war effort. Is it a communications problem from the administration or from the from NATO that is leading people to just kind of feel like it's almost just a political issue and not one that has really global security implications?
I mean, that's a good point. It might be a communications issue. Go ahead, Katie.
No, you're fine. Ahead, I mean, Katie. I would just also add that I can understand how people are, you know, it has been 2 years. It's been a long 2 years where a lot of things have happened, you know, domestically and internationally. And like, for a lot of people, it's hard to justify this amount of money being sent, you know, internationally. Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of all of those things that you listed. So yeah.
I think people, you know, the more something's in crisis, the less of a crisis people view it as, right? They get used to it. And so I think that might be at play too.
So Congress has passed it. And, you know, I think in the past, or at least oftentimes you oftentimes hear things dying in the Senate because of some of the they're a little bit archaic rules, but the rules of, you know, getting closure and bringing up for debate, and sometimes things can stall. Whereas in the House, it's typically, you know, the majority rules and the vote. You know, it's easier to move things through the House, and this is a situation where it's the other way around. The will was in the Senate, and then you hit the House. Whether you're the Speaker of the House, the Republican majority, or the Democrat minority, you know, there's not much separating you two, but it's getting the bill to the floor. What is your expectation about when Congress is going to be bringing this up, and what are some of the mechanisms being used? And for everybody who's in the audience, hey, this is going to be a civics 101 because it's absolutely crazy. It's not just like, hey, let's bring a bill up to the floor and have a Democratic vote. There's a whole process behind it that's really actually interesting, and you can kind of see how every tool in the toolbox is being used for something like this.
Yeah, this isn't as simple as the jingle goes. I'm only a bill or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was just going to say.
If only it were.
I was just going to say before Madison has like a whole research on how this is done. But both me and Madison were on the Hill for 5+ years. And this year we have had to learn how some of this stuff works because it's a whole different ball game with this Congress. And, you know, the difficulty of a Congress being so even in a way, like there's not a big majority of them just trying to being able to push something, is that these different mechanisms that have been, you know, in the woodwork or whatever have to come out and we all have to learn what they are.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a hallmark of this Congress that more bills are being passed under suspension of the rules than under regular order. So for the listening audience who doesn't know what the hell I just said, suspension of the rules means you're skipping the rules process. You are not, you know, the bill might have come through the committee. It is skipping the rules committee. It is not being reviewed by those members. It is, you know, not being changed by those members.
There's no amendments.
You don't have to vote on the rule to consider the bill and then vote on the bill itself. You are just voting on the bill and you have to have 2/3 of the House vote in support to pass it. So the threshold is higher, but in some ways you can eliminate other challenges. And in this Congress, the other challenges are in the House Rules Committee, where very far-right conservatives have an incredible influence on what those bills look like. So Speaker Johnson has been using suspension to pass a lot of big legislation.
which I would just add is very uncommon. Usually bills that are passed under suspension or, you know, like bills that name a post office or like something that have, you know, passed unanimously out of a committee. So something that is not controversial at all. So the fact that these big pieces of legislation that usually have like, you know, hours on the floor of debate and amendments are being pushed through suspension is a big deal.
And you know, in the main chamber in the House, you know, every member gets a vote, obviously. You know, so you have, I forget, what it was, it 224 Republicans or... I forget what the actual breakdown is.
It's only like 12. It keeps changing because people are retiring they just or added going to court.
Yeah. it's somewhere like it's basically you have about a 10 member lead, you know, changeover. So when you're talking, you know, a handful of members can actually, on either side, can actually cause problems. But, you know, when you get into committees, while a lot of the committees tend to break down similar to what the general House breakdown is, you have something like the Rules Committee, you put certain members on the rules, it can actually be driven a lot more by, more heavily by the majority, whoever that is, and by a certain ideology of that majority, whether it's Republican or Democrat. You know, if and when the chamber will change over in the upcoming election, you know, Democrats will do the same thing more than likely, is put the people that are going to be responsible for their ideological hold on the majority on that rules committee, and that it's not going to be a bare majority in the rules. I think it's a few extra seats there. So that's kind of been the roadblock there. And so it's easier. But I think it also says that when you step back, you're like, wait a second, if most legislation is getting passed by 2/3 and it's not your name in the post office, you know that generally most members are in agreement.
Yep. Mm-hmm. It means it's bipartisan.
And I think that's kind of an encouraging sign. It's just that how you get that to play out in the process can be crazy.
Yes. And there's also there's political talking points are around avoiding regular order, right? People like the sound of what regular order means. And yes, it is an opportunity for members to weigh in more times and shape and craft a bill, which is very important. But to your point, Ken, yes, if 2/3 of the House is voting for something, it's a bipartisan bill, and it's probably where most of America is.
Yeah.
It's more towards the middle.
So where do you think the war supplemental is going to be? Is it going to be a discharge position? Are they actually going to bring it, the Senate version, up? And will it pass, or will they break it down in some way, do something crazy with it we haven't thought of yet?
In this Congress, I have no idea. and I was talking to a member who's heavily involved in the national security space, and his that was also his answer when he was asked was, I think it'll happen, but I don't know how it's going to happen. Right now, there are three viable options. There are two discharge petitions out there, one from a bipartisan discharge position from Rep. Fitzpatrick and Rep. Golden, and then another one from Rep. McGovern. And, you know, there's things that could happen with it, the things that could not happen. The Fitzpatrick one includes... you know, border security provisions to try to attract Republicans to it. You know, a problem with the McGovern one is some Republicans, even if they support what's in it, won't necessarily politically be able to sign on to it because it's led by a Democrat, right? And you're going into election year, so all members are thinking about what does this mean for my reelection? And some of the Republicans who probably would be happy to support it are going to be in really tight, vulnerable races. And so they're going to have to be really careful and really cautious. The other option is defeating the previous question, which is a very it's a procedural maneuver. Happened, I think the last time it happened was like 1988. It doesn't happen very often. Yeah. But, you know, so if House leadership, Republican leadership brings a bill to the floor under a rule and there is a vote on the previous question, the minority can defeat that and then has the ability to bring up a bill for a vote. And that's how they could do it. It would have to be a bipartisan effort to make that happen.
Yeah,
which is
I feel like I think I've only heard of that approach. I think there's been threats of it in the past, and there we go again. I don't exist, so I'm going to
gotta wave your arms around every few minutes.
That's I guess I'm just not, I'm not as dynamic of a host as I think I am or something, because I'm the motion detector isn't working. But anyways, but yes, I mean, I've heard of it, and I don't think I've ever seen it in action. But you know, it's just one of those things that I think it does show that there's a will to get something done. My concern from a policy perspective is, you know, people would tend to look at this this as a package with a price tag, and certainly does. I mean, but at the end of the day, this how we handle this supplemental has far-reaching implications about how our partners around the world view our ability to get things done when global security is at risk. Whether it's in Europe, whether it's in the Pacific region, you know, everybody is watching how this gets done. And I think it's, you know, it's Congress's responsibility to basically make sure that they're just not minimizing the impact of this decision. Have the vote, bring it up. Hopefully it'll be in a couple of weeks, and we'll get the funding. I mean, at some point, yes, we have to come up with something to support the war effort that's not supplemental after supplemental and so forth. Part of that could be done through some sort of something I'd like to call regular order when it comes to the annual appropriations bill. So
that's a nice segue.
That's
a nice segue. I know.
That doesn't exist anymore.
What in the world is going on with the FY 2024? Because this is another one of those, I think, particularly, I think this, the Ukraine bill, because let's face it, what's going on in Ukraine? It's an EW fight. So when we're talking about funding support for Ukraine, we are supporting electromagnetic warfare efforts over there, whether it's by the Ukrainian forces, by NATO. It's an EW fight. The fiscal year 2024, far-reaching implications, again, how we fund government. So where are we at today? I know that I think in the last episode I mentioned, okay, there were two deadlines. Obviously, the fiscal year ended, 2023 fiscal year ended September 30th. 2024 started on October 1st. There were a couple CRs that brought us into this year where everything was divided into two parts. There was a March 1st deadline for like four or five agencies. And then there's a March 8th deadline for kind of the big ones. DOD, I think HHS yep. is in there, mm-hmm. and others. So we're here sitting on March 5th. We're past one deadline. And we have another deadline looming. And where are we at with, you know, what is the next step that Congress is going to take on the 2024 budget?
Yeah. So we are 5 months in the fiscal year. But I think folks are feeling very hopeful about how things are looking. So last week passed another CR, which we are under right now. It takes us to March 8th and March 22nd. And they are expected to vote on what's called a minibus, a package of appropriations bills, midweek this week. Could be Wednesday, could be Thursday, depends. For agriculture, FDA, energy, water, military construction, veterans affairs, transportation, interior, and
CJS.
CJS. Yeah, I'm not going to say the acronym. CJS. Thanks, Katie.
Anytime.
So that's about $559 billion that we're talking about. And then, you know, like I said, I think everyone's feeling pretty good. Of course, as Congress, people have felt very good about other things, and then ended the week and, you know, it didn't go so well. Mm-hmm. So, but I think the general feeling is we're not going to go into a partial government shutdown on the 8th. They should have time to be able to do it. You know, and then the next package, I think we'll see it sometime mid-March. That is the one with defense, mm-hmm. state, foreign ops, financial services, homeland, ledge branch, and HHS. So that's going to be a massive package.
Do you think that they'll try to group, you know, even just the supplemental bill with some of this? Because, I mean, obviously a lot of the money's in the big package, DOD, foreign ops, so forth, have a lot of the pieces in the supplemental just to kind of create, when you have too many votes, I mean, you create too many opportunities for opposition and
angry members.
You know, angry members and hurt feelings. And of course, in an election year, like the fewer times you can go on record, probably the better. So I mean, like, let's just do, you know, an up or down kind of combined thing. So has that been talked about at all?
I mean, this is at the highest levels of how they're going to do this. And I'm not sure that they have figured out how they're going to do it yet. I can see an argument for that, but I could also see the argument being made. One of these things alone is already going to be hard enough. Let's not make it harder. That doesn't help us get more people on board by making, you know, making it tougher. I'm not sure if they would do that or not.
Yeah. Because at the top of the show, I mentioned, you know, I'm here down here in San Antonio at the National Security Collaboration Center, University of Texas, San Antonio. We're doing a workshop on EW resource. And I think the reason why this is so important, I mentioned, obviously, Ukraine. We know that that's why that's important to EW community. This is important to EW community too, particularly obviously from the DOD side, because, you know, when we talk about budgeting, it's not just, hey, we're going to give DOD 800 billion, whatever the price tag is now, and they're good. How we handle the appropriations process affects everything all the way down through, program development, testing, operational, readiness, training. If you can't do things on time because you don't have the money to use when you need it, things get delayed. Once things get delayed, all the cycles get pushed back. It feels as someone who's been out off the Hill now for, 20 years. Holy crap. 20 years. I kind of count myself more as kind of this, general population. It feels like people just view, oh, well, as long as we get them the money at some point, everything is going to be fine. And that's not how budgeting works. That's not how DOD budgeting works. I can't speak to other agencies. From EW community, it's already always on shoestring. We don't have the right capabilities in the field right now. We're behind on technology development. We're behind on resourcing. We're behind on training. We're behind on education. Waiting until March doesn't help us. It actually hurts us in the long term because we're trying to keep pace with threats around the world. And here we are. How do we reverse this? Because I feel like every time I think like it can't get worse. 20 years later, it is. And so what is the sentiment in Congress here in terms of like, okay, it's an election year. I think we already know nothing's going to happen in 2025. I mean, at least, you're not going to get a whole budget done by September 30th in this year. How do you change it? I mean, what is the state of Capitol Hill staff and members that you talk to about, like, just this is an exhausting process and just one that doesn't seem to go anywhere.
And I mean, I think in a way that's a million-dollar question, Ken. I think in the last few years, it has just become more and more increasingly divisive, which is always harder to come to a bipartisan agreement on these kind of bills, right? Like, these are giant pieces of legislation. And for folks that aren't, aware of the process, like, you pass all of these bills, there's like, 12 buckets that they all fall under and in the House, and then you pass all of them on the Senate side, and then they all have to come to a compromise. So it's a long, drawn-out process, and oftentimes, I mean, look at the NDAA this year. Like, the House had one very different version from the Senate, and then they eventually reached a compromise. So how are we going to get from now where, 5 months in, no general compromise on giant pieces of legislation to something that, we're going to reverse back to when folks pass things bipartisanly before the end of September? I mean, I don't even remember the last time that happened. So you would hope that,
I think I was congressional staff at the time. Yeah. I think it was probably like 2000 and I want to say like 2003 or four, like
which
around
is crazy.
That time.
Yeah, which is nuts. Crazy.
Yeah.
But, this Congress was weird, right? I mean, it took how many votes to get a speaker? And then we lost that speaker. And then we got a new speaker. So a lot of, it's not unprecedented. This has happened before. But it's not common. It's very, very unusual. And that has gummed up the process in a way that, you know, I think we probably are still feeling the effects of. That was wasted time at the start of last year, and then wasted time when Speaker McCarthy was lost the gavel, right? That was, again, another chunk of time where we could have been dealing with Ukraine. We could have been working on spending bills. We could have been doing things. And instead, you know, the House is a circus, and where nothing can get done. And now, you know, Speaker Johnson, you know, he is, I think, as a more junior member with the tools that he is doing the best job that he can, but he is a more junior member, right? He doesn't have the years of experience that other members have, which is then also making the process not move as smoothly.
He will after this year, that's for sure.
Yeah. I mean,
because he's gonna be facing literally every play in the before the end of the year.
Yeah. AP government history book.
So I want to talk a little bit about 25, but I, you know, since we were talking about kind of the challenges of delayed fiscal year appropriations, Katie, you mentioned the NDAA that was passed in
December.
Mm-hmm. I think it was signed early January, but even that, like the way the DOD functions from a congressional budget standpoint is a lot different than the other agencies. In terms of there is always this annual appropriations bill, deal with it every year, and then we have the appropriations. Could you talk a little bit about, or Madison, you know, from the HASC perspective? You have an authorization, but you have no appropriations bill. You have no ability to have new starts or new funding assigned. How does that affect the authorization as a process in terms of even the desire for the committee to kind of push things forward when they know that the appropriations process is broken?
Yeah. I mean, I think the HASC has done a very good job, and the SASC, both, you know, sides of the aisle, have done a really good job in pushing this bill in the last few years, even with the appropriation cycle being what it is. Their deadlines, especially on the House side, are very aggressive again this year. So they're trying to, you know, get member requests for programs or for funding and all that sort of stuff. Like, that was due at the beginning of the month. House will take up the bill in committee in the middle of May, hoping to pass it before the August recess. I don't know, Madison, that the Senate has set anything yet, likely will be.
They'll probably follow.
If it's like last year, it'll be something around that. The main thing that changes that has been different in the last few years because of this whole, you know, thing with the budget is that they have to go. They do most of their policy ahead of time, but then for budgeting, they do have to wait to see, like, you know, what happened with last year's / this year's appropriations and what will then the department ask for? Because the department is also waiting to see what Congress will appropriate for this year before they see how they're going to plus up or what they need to do to plus up funding. So that will be, you know, they have to wait for all of that to happen to put in numbers, which makes the whole process drawn out, which is frustrating. Mm-hmm.
So with that, you know, we have the other thing I want to talk about is obviously the 2025. So we haven't finished 2024 yet, but the 2025 budget request from the president is going to drop here shortly. I don't know if it's probably just next week or so after his State of the Union on Thursday. So what are you hearing about the president's budget submission, which is usually DOA, however, kind of like the Pentagon budget, 95% of it actually stays the same as the big ticket items. I just have to read this article from the House Budget Committee. So the title is, obviously this is from the majority Republicans, because I just found it so tremendously ironic. T minus 1 week. until Biden drops FY 2025 bomb, budget bomb. And they're chastising the president for that he's 35 days after the legal deadline to submit his budget.
I believe this is what they call calling the kettle calling the pot black.
I'm like reading this article. I'm like, oh my God. I want to know the editing process that took place on this, but clearly, you know, this is the president's budget is going to be DOA, but he's going to talk about it on Thursday. Typically, these State of the Union addresses. This one's going to be. I might actually grab popcorn and watch a little bit of it because I think that
popcorn, you know, whether and some wine, yeah.
Whether you watch MSNBC, Fox News, The Daily Show, it's going to be or other late night TV. It's going to be all throughout at the end. What are you hearing about in terms of, particularly from the defense perspective? What are some of the things you're hearing that you expect the administration to come out on, challenge Congress, challenge you know, both his party, Biden's party, the Democrat Party, as well as the Republican Party, you know, moving forward here in the last year of his first term? Obviously, we don't know what's going to happen, you know, next year. So what do you expect to hear from them on that?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of defense, I think we've talked about one of these quite a bit already is I think, you know, we'll probably hear something from him on Ukraine and we'll hear something about Israel and Gaza. Because the administration's handling of the war in Gaza is a point of contention for a lot of Democrats. Mm-hmm. And there's a potential that will lead to a lot of young Democrats staying home on election day. They're unhappy with Biden. They don't want to vote for Trump, but they don't necessarily want to vote for the president either. So I would expect on defense, we'll hear about those two things. I think he's also going to use the speech as an opportunity to drive home his accomplishments. There have been a lot during his administration that people just don't even think about and they don't associate with him. So it's really an opportunity for him to demonstrate everything that he has done and also, you know, a lot of pressure on him to not misstep. You know, don't trip. Don't, you know, I mean, the man has a stutter. It's not old age, but he does get slammed by that or slammed by that. So things like things of that nature, too. You know, last year he had this great viral moment where Republicans were jeering. I would expect they'll probably do something similar to try to throw him off, distract him from the teleprompter so that he appears confused or whatever. And you know what? Last year he went off script and he did great.
Yeah.
So I think everyone's sort of hoping for that outcome, but I think a lot of people are concerned, you know, it's a lot of pressure.
Who is giving the Republican counter? Has that been released?
Yes.
All of a sudden I realized, I'm like,
that's
the other piece to this.
They picked a young woman.
No one ever listens to this part of it, but we'll figure that out. What do you think, like, what will the Republican response be? What are you hearing from the other side they want to hear, they expect to hear, and how do you think that will play with their party, which is divided, similar to when the Democrats were in the majority and they were divided? So, I mean, it's kind of two different parties, but they kind of are dealing with both the same thing. Yeah. It's just you handle it differently, whether you're in the majority or the minority.
Yeah. Katie, I think you know the name.
I looked it up. It's Senator Cade Britt from Alabama. I don't know that I know much else about her, but I think that's who it is.
I don't know what the other side is going to say. And maybe this is giving away sort of my own leanings of what I pay attention to.
Madison, I come from Republican side and I don't know what they're going to say. So, I mean,
okay, good. Great.
I mean,
a lack of clarity.
Exactly. Not knowing what's going on is the bipartisan issue of the day.
Which,
so
I mean, also, I mean, that's sort of what I would say we're seeing from the potential Republican nominee for president, too, we don't exactly have a clear message on what is the agenda. What is, you know, there's been a lot of, and you see this from congressional Republicans as well, focusing on, oh, the crooked Biden family, you know, looking back and not painting a picture of what lies ahead. I do think it's interesting that they picked a woman from Alabama, though, after the court ruling on IVF. So they might be trying to do some repairing of, you know,
of that.
Yeah. On that side of things.
So we have, so the president's budget will come out, I think, what was it, like the 20th or somewhere. As a
I've heard the 11th, but I mean, the 11th, who knows? Okay. It always jumps around.
Yeah. So that'll come out. You know, I found it interesting how, you know, he regardless of where you come down on the spectrum, I mean, there has been, the defense bills that have come down have been pretty solid delivered to Congress in terms of at least top line funding. You can quibble about various priorities and so forth, but you know, in the past, the typical approach was, particularly from a political party perspective, was, you know, Democrats try to cut defense, Republicans try to increase defense. That's kind of actually flipped on its head now.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, from a top line level, you're actually looking at the higher level coming from the Democrat side and the efforts to try to bring that cost down coming from the Republican side. So not really sure, you know, that's a complicated, that's a whole nother area we won't dive into. But what are you thinking in terms of, what are you hearing in terms of like the defense budget, just the growth, just top line? There's a lot of details no one knows because no one sees it yet. Anything to kind of add about what to expect with that to come out?
Yeah, I think this year we're not going to see a whole lot of massive changes, both in the PB and also from what Congress turns out. That's what we've heard from the Hill is what to expect. It's not going to be anything big.
It's just going to be pretty safe. Yeah.
And learning how to, you know, move forward with funding that's there, essentially. So,
Okay.
So then, I mean, obviously, like we said, it doesn't really matter what's in the budget, quite frankly, because we already know that it's not, there's not going to be a budget and there's not going to be a shutdown. No one's going to shut down the government on September 30th, not an election year. So there's going to be a CR September 30th till sometime after the election. Will probably December, at which time, depending on the outcome, could get kicked to next year again.
But they might not want to do that, right? If the House is going to flip in January, which indications seem to think that it will, Republicans, there's going to be an incredible amount of pressure to try to secure
to get something done. So there won't be a CR. Yeah, there won't be a CR automatically to next year, but you'll probably give the current Congress one more shot after the election to do something. Super Tuesday. I mean, so now if you're listening to this podcast, you were not here in the audience, Super Tuesday will have already passed by a day. But today, as we're recording it, it is taking place primaries in all over the country. I think it's probably roughly a quarter of the states, but 16, when you think of it in terms of
16 states.
16. Is that a quarter? I can't do math.
But don't ask me to do math.
It's more than a quarter. So, okay. But, you know, but some key states too that, you know, are going to play big into the election. We're not here. Obviously, we're not here to say one should win or not, but, you know, AOC does not take any position politically or involve itself in any political activity. But we do want to understand kind of, you know, we talked earlier, bare majority right now in the House. Senate's same. Senate's unique in that this year, Democrats are defending a lot of seats.
And really vulnerable seats.
And very vulnerable seats. There's some key races there. Some key races in the House, obviously incumbency rules. There's some key races. What are some of the races that are getting attention in terms of just, you know, they're obviously kind of bellwether districts. What happens in that district is going to kind of determine what happens with the overall, throughout the overall country.
Yeah, I mean, there's some interesting stuff happening this Super Tuesday. You know, in Alabama, for example, not that it's, I think it's necessarily a bellwether for anything, but it is interesting that you have two Republicans who are in the Congress right now competing for a seat, because the way that the map was redrawn created a district that is very likely to go Democratic, right? And one of them is, say, more a more non-MAGA Republican, and the other one is definitely farther to the right competing. So that will be interesting to see how that plays out, especially in a state like Alabama, where there's been a lot of press coverage right now. You know, the other things, the other seats that I think will be really interesting from Super Tuesday are the California races, to see how some of those incumbent Republicans do, because they're facing primary challengers from farther to the right. So including, you know, Congressman Calvert on the Appropriations Committee, strong Republican member on defense issues. And he has a challenger from the right. You know, if he loses his primary and it's a farther right Republican, it potentially makes that seat easier for Democrats to grab. Of course, I don't know the ins and outs of all the districts, so I don't know, but there's a potential that it could.
Well, you have the ins and outs of the district is also, and also the, with each state handles these primaries differently. They're not all straight up, you know, vote for your favorite candidate. You know, you have, I know I'm from Pennsylvania, so you have to identify with a party in order to vote in the primary. In Virginia, you just vote, and you can vote in either primary, but you can only vote in one. So you vote in the most compelling race.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's different ways. And so it's really kind of hard, but I do think that, you know, this today marks kind of, I mean, I would expect Donald Trump to be the presumptive nominee after today. I think if the polls hold close, he's probably going to be pretty close to what he needs. If not, you know, it's basically done.
Yeah.
And so you have that clarity. You have you're going to see kind of his down ballot effect on in those states. You know, what effect did he have? You know, are people voting for him and his candidate? Are people voting for him, but the more moderate Republican? Are they voting? Are they splitting tickets in some way? Depending on how they vote and how the states allow them to. So, really kind of interesting. There'll be a lot of kind of churn on that. But basically, today is the start of what I kind of view as the start of the election season. Yep. Yeah, it's been going on for a while, but Super Tuesday now, from here on out, it's a sprint.
General election.
To the election.
Kicks off. Yeah. You know, it is interesting. It's funny, the head of the fundraising arms in the Senate, both in the D and the Republican side, both obviously have very different perspective on if Trump is on the ticket, when Trump is on the ticket, what the effect will be. You know, the Democrats see it as a good thing for Democrats because people are motivated to come out against him. Republicans see it as a good thing for them because Trump voters are super motivated to vote for him. So it is hard to say how that effect will happen or what that effect will be. The other thing that I would flag, just, you know, we haven't talked about Nikki Haley and how what her race is demonstrating, but I think, you know, she's been grabbing like 1/3 of Republican votes, which I don't think is a good thing for Trump. It says that there's a big portion of the Republican Party that doesn't want to vote for him. And so, you know, what does that mean on election day? Does that mean they turn out and vote for Biden, or they stay home? Or does she endorse Trump after if she drops out of the race and then people vote for Trump anyway because she has said this is fine? It's unclear. It'll be interesting to see what she does after Super Tuesday.
Yeah, she was, and it'll be interesting to see, well, what she does, and then also I think what, you know, the Trump camp will, how, what efforts they'll make to either bring in those voters by moderating, because typically you do kind of speak to your base in the primary, you speak to the middle, and that's where a lot of the people currently are. They're not happy with the, I never thought, I mean, 2020 I thought was insane, and I thought for sure we wouldn't be doing the exact same thing again, and that's where we are. So shows you what I know. And but I do think that it'll be interesting to see what role does she play in the Republican convention. You know, what is her messaging or her community, her group's messaging? So that'll be interesting. Anything else that's kind of on your mind here as we kind of wrap up the conversation for today? I think we covered a lot. Basically, you know, I think at the end of the day, I came from Capitol Hill back in the good old days when you had the Republican majority was led by Newt Gingrich and Dick Armey. You had the Clinton scandals, the Clinton impeachment. You had, you know, Henry Hyde and all these other icons in the Republican and Democrat Party. And you had a government shutdown. You had a speaker, you know, ousting. And it all seems so normal compared to 2024 that it's kind of weird. It's kind of scary to think that you would long for that type of chaos compared, because at the end of the day, we still got a budget done. So really interesting time. Really, really do appreciate, you know, the time you spent on Capitol Hill talking to the members, talking to the EW working group that we have. The other thing I want to mention too, though, for those in the audience is, you know, we have a number of members on Capitol Hill, members of Congress that care about EW, they're tracking it. They're going to be engaged in the NDAA process. They're engaged in all the funding discussions. And, you know, I think that the interest in that in Congress is growing. As kind of a parting way, parting message, you know, talk a little bit about EW awareness on Capitol Hill, what you've seen since joining AOC and kind of working with the congressional education.
Yeah, I mean, I would say I come from the office of Representative Rick Larson, who is one of the co-chairs of the EW Working Group and has been for a while. I think our work with the EW Working Group has been great. They promote a lot of education about EW with briefings and with legislation and all that sort of stuff on the House side. And I think with our time in AOC and Ken before us, we've done a lot of touch points with members who are all, there's a good amount of members on both sides of Capitol Hill with, you know, Senate and House that are interested in this kind of work and want to see it get done. So I think we're in a good place. There is a big title in last year's NDAA on EW, meaning there's a big section on EW in the bill, which is kind of unprecedented and is great, which shows there's a lot of engagement and we're at a good place to keep the momentum going.
Well, Madison, Katie, thank you for taking time out of your schedule to join me here on From the Crow's Nest for our bonus edition. It's great to chat with you. It was great seeing you a couple of weeks ago when I came down to Capitol Hill to meet with folks. And so appreciate you taking time to join me.
Yeah, we're always happy to do it. Thanks for having us.
Right. Well, that will conclude this episode of From the Crow's Nest, our live subscriber bonus edition. I want to thank Madison and Katie from Forza DC for joining me. You can learn more about them if you're interested at ForzaDC.com. I also want to thank those in the audience today for joining us and for taking time out of their lunch schedule or whenever it hits on their calendar. But appreciate that you taking time to join us as well. Also, we would greatly appreciate it if you followed, shared, commented on the show. We always enjoy hearing from our listeners. So please let us know how we're doing. It helps us refine the way that we approach each episode, and we really value it. This episode, recorded here on Tuesday, March 5th, we will air it tomorrow, Wednesday, March 6th. So please check that out. Our regular From the Crow's Nest episode is going to be out next week. And we will be talking about the new EA-37B compass call. So very good discussion there. That's it for today. Thanks for joining me. Fast Labs, powered by BAE Systems, is at the forefront of advanced technology and defense research, development, and production. They're pushing boundaries, breaking barriers, and innovating for a safer world. Check them out at www.baesystems.com/fastlabs.